Rehabilitation Center.
This is Guardian Radio, your station for up-to-the-minute news, intelligent, interactive, and engaging conversation. 96.9 FM. The views and opinions of the hosts and guests are their own and do not necessarily reflect the position of the management and staff of Guardian Network.
Off the Record with Chicago Lang is sponsored by Royal Fidelity Bank and Trust, Burger King, and Royal Star Assurance.
Live. I'm Chivago Lang, your host. So glad that you could join us here today on Guardian Radio, 96.9 FM on this beautiful Wednesday afternoon. This beautiful Wednesday afternoon. So glad that you could join us here today. I'm Chivago Lang, your host, and I'm here with Mrs. Leslie Archer, who is a policy fellow in the Government and Public Policy Institute and joins me on these Wednesdays to talk about some of these matters. If you are interested in calling the show today, and I hope you do, because we're going to have a kind of open show to hear your queries, questions, comments. Today, I'm going to discuss something about the interplay between the Parliament and the Cabinet. We are going to talk about that today. But if you want to give us a call at all on the show, the numbers are 323-6232, that's 323-6232, or 325-4316, 325-4316, or 325-4259, that's 325-4259. You can text us on 422-4796, that's 422-4796, or you can WhatsApp us, WhatsApp me on 439-3043, that's 439-3043. Let me just say, just before Leslie and I begin, that I am very proud today to say that I am headed to Halifax in a couple of days to watch my second son graduate university, having earned a bachelor's degree in finance. No, I did not tell the young man he should go do finance, but I did speak to him about these matters and what they entail. And yes, he decided to do finance. And he has been blessed and fortunate to have gotten a position at Butterfield Bank in Halifax. And so I want to congratulate Shamal Malik Lang. And on Saturday, he will walk across the stage having received bachelor's degree in finance. Very proud of him and happy to be able to go and celebrate with him on that occasion. I have to tell you all, you know, when I graduated University of Western Ontario, actually, I walked across the stage by myself with no one in the audience per se, because in those days, traveling wasn't so easy to accommodate, but I'm happy and proud to be able to go and join my son as he does so. Leslie Archer, how are you, ma'am?
I am wonderful, Mr. Lange. Congratulations on your son graduating.
Thank you. He's going to make the second. My eldest child, my son, Shivago Jr., actually graduated with a bachelor's degree in finance from the University of Bahamas, too.
Really?
Yeah.
You know what that means, Mr. Lange? You're getting old, man.
Yeah, definitely. I'm running. I can feel it in my knees, too. That's why I'm trying to lose weight, right? Because, you know, you can't age and put on weight. Because that's gonna take a toll on your knees. So I'm trying to.
I mean, you gotta keep it together.
So but it's even worse than that, Leslie. My daughter is in her third year at Florida Atlantic University.
Ah, Lord. You know, my dad always told us when we were younger, he was like, listen, y'all get y'all education because when I retire and when y'all straight, I need y'all to send me on a cruise with y'all black credit card.
Yeah. Yes.
Just send me so I can make sure I stay fit so I can go.
Yes, I can need that little thing. That's young people say, right?
Exactly.
I'm getting old when I'm pulling off from the barber and my 13-year-old son says, now, Daddy, you're not leaving anything, eh? I said, what you mean? Because I don't want you ride off and then have to turn around and say you left something. So you ain't leaving that day. Oh, boy, what a time. Leslie, we haven't spoken to you on the air since election.
That was before the election.
Yes. So your impressions of what has happened, thoughts, anything?
I am eager to see, you know, Davis says, let's get to work. So I just want to see. I'm hopeful.
Right.
I'm hopeful, and I think that's the best I can do.
As we all must be, hey.
We all must be. We can't look negative. We don't need that right now. Not at this time. Yeah, I'm definitely hopeful. In terms of third parties, the influence, and we saw, I was unsure what I was going to do at the polls. But when I arrived at the polls, I felt so sure. I don't even know what came over me. Like, who I was going to vote for. It was just this sense of calmness,
right,
and security I felt. And even with who won now, I feel like there's hope, not that there's hope that things will be okay, because I guess a lot of seasoned persons are in. And I'm generally one to say, you know, bring more young persons in and let it mix up. But I feel a sense of comfort and security.
Mm.
My preliminary feelings, and not big in politics on it. But I don't know. I just feel a sense of like, okay, I'm holding my breath, but I feel we're going to be okay.
Right. So there's a mix. You got a mix of experience in there for sure. Some of
right.
the more veteran people. And you got a mix of newer, fresher bodies in there as well. And so yeah, you can at least, you know, the last administration, I'm trying to think, the only persons who had previous cabinet experience in the cabinet were Prime Minister, former Prime Minister, Dr. Hubert Minnis himself. And then Dion Foulkes, who was in the Senate, did. And then Dion, Carl Bethel, who was also in the Senate. And then for a time, Brent Simonette, who was also in the Parliament. So in the Parliament itself, the only persons who had previous cabinet experience, to my recollection, were Prime Minister Minnis, former, and Brent Simonette. Oh, sorry, Desmond Bannister also
had previous
cabinet experience. So the bulk of the cabinet certainly was not experienced persons. Now, was that the reason things may not have gone as well as some might have thought? I can't say that was altogether the reason, but if you're talking about having more confidence in the mix of experience you have in the minute, the Davis administration, Mr. Davis himself, who served as Deputy Prime Minister formerly, you have Glenisanna Martin, you have Ryan Pinder, who was also a minister prior, Hal Kiedis, who was a minister prior. You now have Yvonne Miller, who was a parliamentary secretary prior. I'm trying to think if anyone else that I missed who had previous cabinet experience. I did mention Glenisanna Martin, right?
Yeah, you said a second.
Yeah. So there are certainly a number of persons, I don't know if it's going to be the majority again, who are in the mix to provide that kind of support to others if they will take it and provide some stability and guidance to the country. So
yeah, and shout outs to the women that won too.
I was happy about that. Absolutely. And in fact, we have now, to my recollection, one more than the maximum we had at any given time. In 1997, there was a period of time when we had six. I'm going to get it for you. We had six women who were in the House of Assembly. And so that would have been the most we had at any given time. So now with the seven that we have more than we certainly would have had in any time prior. So that was in 1992, we had four women. And then in 1997, that's right, I was right, we had six. We had the first female Speaker of the House of Assembly at the time, and Atalia Johnson. We had Sylvia Scriven. We had Johnny Ann Dorsett. We had Janet Boswick was in the House. We had Cynthia Mother Pratt was in the House. And then we had to meet Teresa Moxie Ingram in the House. So it was six. So this one additional person makes historically the most females we have had in the House of Assembly at any time in our history. So congratulations to all of them. Do us proud and demonstrate that level of potency that we know that you can bring. Leslie, you might comment on this because this was a lesson I learned from a guru of mine. And what he said was, people mistake femininity with female and masculinity with male. Because he said, every one of us has feminine and masculine in us. And feminine, he says, or masculine, he says, is the gift you have to actually make a life. Okay, make a life. So the masculine in the caveman days would be that individual who goes out there, gets the food so that you can live and eat. But the feminine in the person is the thing that makes the life you got worth living. So they make of the house which you live in a home which you want to live in. And that isn't a feminine, a female or male trait. It is a quality of being that everybody has. But at different times in life, he says, and at different periods in history, the feminine or the masculine was more dominant. So in times past, when the work was mostly physical, etc., the masculine was more required. And it didn't mean that a woman didn't step up to the plate and do the masculine, but it just meant that in most instances, the men did the masculine, calling on their masculinity. But he says, as history moved on and we became more cerebral in our workings, now you have more the feminine required, but you still have many people still focusing on the masculine. And so we don't have as nurturing an environment as we would have because we won't let the feminine in us come out. And it's nothing to do with female or being soft or anything. It's just a focus and emphasis on nurturing life such that it is worth living. And I thought it was beautiful something.
Okay.
And to my mind, the reason why I pointed out is because maybe these women, because they will be more in touch with their feminine, can bring policy outlooks and policy perspectives that can be more nurturing to the environment in which we find ourselves, and encourage more of their men to get in touch with that same side of themselves and bring more nurturing and more and bring more worth living to the efforts of the government.
You know, there was a study done. I don't remember the international organization behind it, but it said during times of conflict, of intense conflict, that a female leader operates more effectively or is likely to have more success in terms of mediating differences than males do. I mean, there is power to the woman, right?
Yeah, I can see that could be true too, because especially as we tend to shape them, you know, women tend to come at life with more empathy, you know, and more willingness to see what a person is going through. So that if you have conflict and you are able to see what both sides are going through, maybe you can mediate the conflict better. So again, we'll see. We had six before. Did it make a difference? I guess you'd have to do the study to know. But we'll see whether there is some outcome in this administration that makes a difference. So,
but hold on. I want to. Yeah. There will be an outcome just because of their presence. Mm. You have younger persons coming up, and they could see the House of Assembly with men and women in it too. Just have that image while you're young that now this is something I see on the regular. So this is a norm to have females in this position, a place, whether they operate effectively or not, just their presence.
Yes.
Creates an influence, creates an impact, and produces an outcome that translates into the next generation.
And if we do it by legislation or we do it by party policy, I really believe that going forward, parties ought to make it a point to optimize the participation of women. And by optimize, I mean, it may well be that on some occasions, you might have a majority of women candidates. I wouldn't have a difficulty with that, because if they're the best fit for the job, they're the best capable to do the job, I have no difficulty. Let's get the best fit. But certainly decide that you aren't going to go fall below a certain minimal threshold for female participation in your candidates' lineup. I don't think we should ever go to a place where you got 2 and 3 persons running in a 39 slate of candidates. I don't think we should do that.
Yeah, agreed. I mean, we have the intelligence and the machinery, really. If we don't even look at the intelligence of the individual, we have the political machinery that could ensure that, you know, whoever is running or representing can have a viable chance or opportunity to lead or to be that face leading.
Okay, yeah, right. Okay, so I wanted to look at, Leslie, this notion that we have about the extent to which because there's being named a cabinet now. And if I'm not mistaken, the size of that cabinet may end up being of the order of 17, 18. As I recall it, there were, besides the prime minister yesterday, there was 6 or so sworn in, 6 cabinet ministers. Today there'll be 8. So if I'm not mistaken, that would make 17, if not 18 or so cabinet ministers that we may end up with. And if that is true, and the Progressive Liberal Party had 34 members elected to the House of Assembly, then that means that as a percentage, that means that 52-53% of the members of parliament will in fact be in the cabinet. That's what that would mean. And that would be consistent with what we have done in times past in these scenarios in which I'm wrong because it was the Progressive Liberal Party has 31 seats, right?
And I'm picking it up now as you see.
Yeah, so that break drives it up to 58%. 58%, right? So that means that you will have about 12 or 13 persons who are not in the cabinet of the Progressive Liberal Party administration. Again, that's fairly consistent with what has happened over the past elections in this country. Now, that's only the cabinet ministers. So it could be that you have a member of parliament appointed to some board, because I haven't seen as an executive chairman, maybe even, because I haven't seen anything from the Progressive Liberal Party saying as a policy they will not appoint politicians to boards. And so it is conceivable that by extension, some other members of parliament may join the administration, right? Because if you are sitting as chairman of an executive chairman, in particular of a board, you are not going to, you're not going to fuck the government. That ain't normal. So it as it now stands, for the people who have concerns about too many members of parliament being in the House of Assembly and cabinet ministers, well, I think we are past that threshold already. Because most, if my numbering is right, of the members of parliament, well, let's see, because you have two senators, right? You have two senators. There, Ryan Pinder, and you have Michael Halkidis. I don't know that any other senator was named. Okay, so you have almost 50%, if not more, of the members of parliament will sit in the cabinet, and that's not counting yet whether any of them will be appointed to boards. Okay, so people have the thought that when you have that many members of parliament in the cabinet, that does something to the holding accountable the cabinet. Now, that notion assumes a couple of things that I can tell you from experience is absolutely not the case. In most instances, right? It assumes that a member of parliament is sitting there thinking, well, I'm not in the cabinet, therefore I'm not going to agree with everything the government puts forward. I want you to hear me again now. The member of parliament who got elected on a PLP ticket is sitting there thinking, having got elected on a PLP ticket, being myself a PLP, wanting the PLP to be in office, I am going to, because I'm not in the cabinet, be an independent voice to speak against my party when something arises. That's the assumption. Yes, the second assumption is that a prime minister will not be competent enough, effective enough, to go and consult with his members of parliament prior to bringing something to the parliament, such that he lobbies and gets their support to say, here's what we're doing, tell me what you think, yes, we agree, and therefore when we go to parliament, we're not going to go and vote. That's the second thing, that that's not going to happen. And I can tell you that too is a fallacy. Not always, but some, most times that's a fallacy, because you have what you call parliamentary meetings where you are roaching some of these and other politicians. The third thing is that you think that members of parliament who are not in the cabinet do not understand that if your government brings a bill to the parliament and that bill loses a vote, that that is a no vote of no confidence in the government, and the government really has no other choice but to go to the electorate to seek re-election. And so they are going to just willy-nilly toss their government aside and take the chance that people are going to re-elect them, when in fact they are opposed to their government and therefore represent their own people in the matter. So frankly speaking, it is a huge leap to think that even if you get a smaller cabinet with more members of parliament not in the cabinet, that they are going to willy-nilly be much more independent and hold you accountable to the extent that they are going to risk the tenure of their party in government. I can tell you, based on my own experience, that's a tall leap. Not an impossible leap, but it is a pretty tall leap. I'll stop and see if you have some thoughts on that, Les.
I mean, is that what people are saying? Because I just feel like we have a pandemic to address right now.
No, that is what people are saying. I'm listening to the radio. I'm listening to the shows. I've listened to them over the weeks and weeks. And that is a concern.
And it's like,
it is a concern. Yeah? It is a concern. Their concern is they would like to have, and I think it's a legitimate concern, they'd like to have more independence on the part of their members of parliament. And why wouldn't they have that concern now? We are forming a government. And even as you form it now, that issue for them is alive and real. Okay, we have a pandemic. We have a pandemic, for instance, and they might think, well, you know, the government might decide to do this. We need some people who are there to say, no, we, even if we're with you, we don't think that's right.
I mean, I think now is a good opportunity for the people to form their organizations and organize themselves to hold the government responsible. This is the time to do it. Even the third parties, it's not time for them to disappear. It's time for them to get together tighter and stronger. It's time for, you know, we have other, as many points of accountability and demanding of transparency and responsibility, that we can put that in the hands of the people, the same ones who complaining or, you know, making their suggestions, that they take it to action and create their own accountability parts.
Absolutely.
That's just what I'm thinking.
Yeah, absolutely.
You're more active civil society. Like, that's where my interest is, to get a more active and more educated civil society, because we are the ones who, like you say all the time, we are the ones who hire the politicians. So we need to make sure they're doing their job.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. And your point is,
this is a cause.
And your point is even stronger when you consider that politicians trade on popularity. That's their currency. Because to get elected, you need to be popular, more popular than the other guy. And so you trade on popularity. If civil society and others are active enough to hold into account the government, as you say, then they have opportunity to use the press and the media and the social platforms and the like, so the social media platforms and the like, to be able to do exactly what you say. And anytime you are eroding the popularity of politicians or a group of politicians or a politician, you are going to have an effect, because they know it. That's their currency. That's what they carry to the bank when it's time to get elected and stay in power. So to the extent to which you leverage that popularity to produce outcomes that generate value for the country, is the extent to which that power you have as a civil society well.
Yeah, so I mean, I pretty much just say, you know, look in the mirror, what can you do to hold, and how can you get people together in your community or at your job, and to ensure that as we get off to this right start, that the government doesn't think that they could pass one on us or slip one on us, not at this time, not anymore.
We have a text here that says, congratulations, Mr. Lang, on your son's graduation. I celebrate with you and your family. Appreciate it. Thank you very much. Appreciate that. We have another text. We have another text here says, the PLP has 32 seats. Okie dokie. That may well be so. Okay, ladies and gentlemen, we're going to take a break, our first break. You're listening to Z Live. I'm Shabago Lang, your host, and I'm here with Mrs. Leslie Archer. We'll be back after this break. I'm not afraid to take a stand, take a stand.
Marsh the car. The lady run into me, marsh the car.
I hope she had insurance.
If she had insurance, she hop out, pull out her phone, pull up the Royal Star Assurance app, and bang, she was on a video call with an RSA rep, sending pictures of her damage, my damage, filing a claim on the spot.
For real? Our insurance have that kind of app?
You gotta go to RSA for that.
Download the RSA app today, or visit rsabahamas.com to submit your claim online. Live chat available weekdays 9 to 5.
Have you taken a look at those investment options yet?
Too busy. Look at today. Workout, breakfast, drop kids at school, back-to-back meetings, dog from the groomer, nails, and that's all. How come you're so chill?
That's because my money is as busy as you.
At RF, we find the best Bahamian and international investments to keep your money busy so you can spend more time focusing on you. Contact us at rfgroup.com to find out more. RF, money at work.
Have you heard about the COVID vaccine raffle? If you are vaccinated against COVID-19, you can enter to win amazing prizes like food store gift certificates, hotel stays, beach excursions, and so much more. Even if you are previously vaccinated, you can still enter to win. The COVID vaccine is free, safe, and protects you from severe COVID-19 infections. Don't delay. Get vaccinated today and enter to win. Visit www.vaxbahamas.com to register.
I'm not afraid to take a stand, take a stand. Everybody, everybody, come take my hand, come take my hand. We'll walk this road together through the storm. Whatever weather, cold or warm, saying you're not alone. Holla if you feel like you've been down the same
and gentlemen to Z Live. I'm Shavaro Lang, your host. So glad you could join us here today on Guardian Radio 96.9 FM. I'm here with Mrs. Leslie Archer, who is a policy fellow in the Government and Public Policy Institute. So glad you could join us. If you want to give us a call, that are all the numbers to do so are 323-6232 or 325-4316 or 325-4259. You can text us on 422-4796 or WhatsApp me on 439-3043. Whatever the size of the Davis cabinet, whatever the size of the remaining non-cabinet members of parliament, there are heavy issues that are on the table for this administration. Heavy issues to be addressed against the backdrop of a government financial situation that is severely strained and against the backdrop of a continuing global pandemic. I dare say that what the Davis administration does in these earliest of days in addressing one, the pandemic, two, the economy, three, the fallout socially of the from the economy, and four, the confidence the crisis of confidence that people have in government. Those four areas in particular, to my mind, what they do earliest, both in signaling and in addressing the actions to be taken, the actions taken, are going to determine whether 8 to 12 months from now, there is a view by the public that one, either nothing has changed, or there's business as usual, or the Bahamas is now in the hands of a new direction toward a new date. And nothing short of concrete commencement of turns in those four areas, I think, will cause people to develop a greater sense of optimism about the way forward. And that's a tall order, and it hasn't been unusual for administrations to, in the face of the strain of turning things around, to lean on what the former administration did. And while some of that gets played and can have carriage in some places, generally the public is not interested in that kind of talk. What the public is interested in is, what are you doing about it? And whether or not I am able and beginning to feel the benefits of what you are doing about it. United States of America only recently said, come November, if you want travel to the United States of America, you're going to have to be vaccinated. And it is conceivable in my mind that that could be, in fact, a jolt toward even greater vaccination. Now, there is vaccine inequity in the world, for sure. But so much of the world interacts with and travels to the United States of America. I think the press will be on governments around the world now, and by extension, back to the United States, to really be more equitable in the distribution of those vaccines, given this great demand being placed on the global community in respect to traveling to the United States. Forget for the moment that people travel to the United States for pleasure. There are millions and millions of businesses that are business people that traverse the United States of America, through the United States of America, doing business around the globe. True or not true?
Very true.
So my own sense is that that might produce a bit of uptick. Do you yourself wonder in these early days how the administration goes about setting its course and direction as to how to what to do and address in the country so many issues?
Wouldn't that be in the plan that they put forth, you know, in their proposal or in their pitch for governance?
And that's a great question. Here's the thing, though. The plan doesn't give priorities as such, right? So the plan isn't saying, I'm going to address this first, address that second. The plan says, in all these different areas, here's what we're going to do. And so now you have got to organize around, okay, where do you concentrate your efforts? Of course, you have ministers have to deal with all parts of the business and so forth. But the money is not so easily distributed. The work is there, but you now it is in a household. You have your money, and you now have to make determinations as to where you apply the money in order to get the greatest impact. And that means that you have to have some priorities.
Okay, so how do they do that? I'm assuming international agencies play an important role. I'm also assuming that prior government agreements and things that they might have signed up for would play a role, like especially contracts that they perhaps can't get out of, would play a role in determining their priorities.
Well, I can tell you this much. In my experience, the priorities get set by the prime minister. I can tell you that much. I can't say that it's been my experience that there is a sit down of the whole and there is a determination that, okay, folk, you know, there's only so much dollars, and so can we sit and decide where we can spend it? That has not been my experience. Typically, what happens is the prime minister and the Ministry of Finance kind of set the tone for what are the priorities. And sometimes that's easier than not, because some issues are so blatant, right? No, it's urgent to address them. So for instance, when we came to office in 2007, there was the Great Recession. And so as to what is to be done and focused on, there was no question. That was a global crisis. And so you knew that you had to pay attention to the fallout from that global crisis. And so it set the priority. We didn't have a chance to, it did. When Ingram came to office in 92, there was a huge hurricane. Well, it set the priority for him in that period of time. And so sometimes things do that. Now, for instance, when Dr. Minnis came to office, the pandemic was not a crisis. Dorian hit like a year or two later, and then the pandemic. But now you have a new administration where the pandemic is right there up in your face. So is it possible for you to make that a secondary issue? It would be very difficult given that so many other things depend on addressing and containing that issue. But outside of those blatant issues, I would think the best way to deal with it is really to have a sit down with your team and agree on what things ought to get the most focused attention, and therefore where financing and funding, where necessary, would be directed. And then that means that the others have to understand, that means that we can't direct funds in your direction right away. So don't go out there trying to promise the public you can do this, that, and the next thing when you have limited resources to do it.
And I would also like to see one day that in setting the agenda, that if it hasn't been done before, that regional considerations are given face as well. So, you know, where is the region headed? Are you meeting with regional leaders or CARICOM and determining, well, in the next 20 years, the CARICOM region plans to be this in the world, and to integrate that into the his priorities? I think that would be excellent for the Bahamas, regional integration in that way.
Well, I can tell you as a practical issue, and in terms of where we are and have been, for the Bahamas, I could say, regional integration has not been so high on the agenda for sure. Whether it will be now, I think it often depends on whether we see that we can actually benefit in some meaningful and material way in it. That's not to say we haven't pushed regional issues, because at one point Fred Mitchell was very active in pushing for the Bahamas to sign on to the Caribbean single market and economy, which was met with a great deal of resistance in the country. But outside of that, the Bahamas has not been very enthusiastic about regional integration. And this is historic. When we continue to be a part of the CARICOM political community, but refused to join the common market. When CARICOM established the Caribbean single market and economy, we remained a part of the political machinery, but didn't sign on to the single market or an economy, even though the treaty was supposed to be an all-inclusive, all-in kind of thing. The Bahamas did not do so. And my own theory as to why that is because our trade, I follow the money in many of political issues. And if our financial and commercial interest was more tied to the South, we might see a greater interest in integration. But ours is tied to the North. And so that's why we have had a kind of standoffish approach to matters related to Caribbean integration, because really our bread and butter is in the North.
You know, I agree with that point, but I also had a conversation with one of the senior politicians in Barbados who was a part of the CSME movement when my husband and I lived in Barbados. And, you know, when he found out I was from the Bahamas and he started talking about, you know, the Bahamas' role in our decision to stay at a distance, he said, at the end of the day, he understood why the Bahamas said no. And he actually wished that his country, Barbados, and the other countries would have been more understanding to the Bahamas' position. And he said to me that the Bahamas really wanted to be a good sport and be a part to show camaraderie with the Caribbean, but their position was so firm that it had to be an all or nothing, that it had to be, you know, if you say you're going to do this, you need to stand with us holistically in every aspect. And the Bahamas was trying to say, oh, we have different dynamics. We need you to understand that there are different things about us. We are operating in a unique space where we may not necessarily, this route may not necessarily be effective. Can we make a compromise? And they were unwilling to compromise. And he said he regretted that at the end of the day. And on that note, I remember the very first week my husband and I went to school. We left the Bahamas because we both wanted to go back to school. So we went to Barbados and he said, we're going to go to UWI. And the very first day of class, when the students in my husband's class, we did separate classes that day. And when we were walking home to our apartment, it was a deflating experience, because in both of our classes, when they found out that we were from the Bahamas, the other students completely, Mr. Lang, completely yanged up on us.
Y'all didn't join CSME.
Who y'all think y'all are? And yep. My husband and I kind of looked at each other like, what? Like, what are you talking? And this time my husband is already, he's almost twice the age of some of the kids in the class, right? But he looked pretty young. And it was so surprising, that cultural shock, that the generational anger
Bahamians don't know, some Bahamians don't know how intense the views of some Caribbean peoples are about what they regard as the standoffishness of the Bahamas, for sure, in when it comes to integration. That's for sure. We got to take a break, ladies and gentlemen, for news. You're listening to Z Live. I'm Shabago Lang, your host. When we come back, we'll continue our conversation, Leslie Archer and myself. You're listening to Z Live. I'm Shabago Lang, your host. We'll be back after the news break.
This is Guardian Radio, 96.9 FM, Nassau, Bahamas.
Back, we're live. I'm Shabago Lang, your host. So glad you could join us here today on Guardian Radio 96.9 FM on this beautiful Wednesday afternoon. I'm joined here by Mrs. Leslie Archer, policy fellow in the Government and Public Policy Institute at the University of the Bahamas. Today, we are kind of having a free flow conversation about things happening around the government. If you want to give us a call at all or text us, these are the numbers to do so. You can call on 323-6232. That's 323-6232 or 325-4316, 325-4316, or 325-4259, 325-4259. You can also text us on 422-4796. That's 422-4796. So you can WhatsApp me on 439-3043. That's 439-3043. You know, when parties get elected, looking at your promises, the things you promise, and they start looking at the things nearest and dearest to their hearts. And so, for instance, once again, the Progressive Liberal Party has promised to do something about mortgage relief. That being that if a person has a distressed mortgage due perhaps to the pandemic, due to Dorian, et cetera, as happened during the Great Recession, the idea by the Progressive Liberal Party, as they had promised when they came to office in 2012, was that we would do something to bring relief to mortgage holders who have mortgages in distress. Gowan Bo, who is the CEO of the Fidelity Group, commented on this, that this mortgage relief has to be considered in trying to achieve it. He took some time to indicate that banks work with clients anyways, trying to do some mortgage relief. He says, where you have an individual who is communicating with the bank and making payments or payment arrangements, those arrangements will be accepted and accommodated because it's more important for the bank to recover its funds than it is to see repossession or sale of property. He says, when you look at the original mortgage relief plan, there was a limited amount of persons. There was some government subvention issued, which were to the benefit of mortgages in those circumstances. But I think we have to step back and say, what is the primary objective of the administration of the day? If it is to protect persons against losing their homes, it also has to be juxtaposed against persons who are depositors and shareholders in banking institutions. If you force banks to take losses, that will impact other stakeholders. Right? You know, you promise something like mortgage relief, and one or two things is going to happen here. I mean, honestly, one of two things is going to happen. You are either going to have a situation where far more people than not are immensely disappointed because they will not get relief, saving and except for some things happening that I'll talk about in a minute, or you are going to take taxpayer monies and you are going to provide that relief to many more people. Those are the only two circumstances that is going to happen. Because let me tell you what's going to happen, what mortgage relief requires. You enter into a contract, I enter into a contract with a bank to pay a mortgage. Something happens and we are unable. There is within that contract with the bank consequences for non-payment. The bank isn't interested in possessing your property. Why? Because generally speaking, unless you're in Nassau and in a pretty good area, the market for a resale, especially in the family islands, some of them, you know, is very difficult for homes. I'm talking about for homes now. So you find that people could be living in these homes now for months and months and months, maybe even years, because really the bank is saying maybe it's better to have that occupant in there than have the home vacant and then being vandalized and so forth, because the market isn't so robust. But the bank isn't interested in holding the property and getting in the real estate business of buying and selling homes. No, how? They're not interested in that. They would like simply to be able to get a payment, their payment for the mortgage. Well, what will allow a distressed mortgagee to be able to pay their monthly mortgage obligation. A job with sufficient income to make that payment on the planet. Why? Because that is what got them the mortgage to begin with. Could a person have gone to the bank prior to having a job with no income and say, please, sir, I'd like a mortgage for a house. Could you give it for me? No one would be considered for a mortgage under those circumstances. Not a single soul. It was the ability to pay by virtue of a income earning job that allowed that mortgage to be had. Why then would we believe that there is any way outside of that to provide any kind of real and genuine mortgage relief to any soul? That soul needs a job making income to pay that mortgage. Otherwise, the government will have to step in and provide taxpayer money to the banks in part or in whole for a period of time until the same individual is able to pay the mortgage. The government would have to step up and use taxpayer monies to pay that mortgage. Or the government takes legislative action and says to the bank, it is now illegal. It is now no longer possible for you to foreclose on this home as a consequence of the unpayment. And that will no doubt be challenged in the courts, because is that constitutional? Does it breach the contract rights and all these kinds of things? So it is really an untidy situation. And quite frankly, I believe that the government is really interested in mortgage relief. It needs to be interested in accelerating the generation of jobs and income in the country and making sure the people who are distressed, who have distressed mortgage situations, may be able to find jobs capable of helping them service those obligations. But this is going to be, I suspect, one of, like the VAT reduction, that people are going to be looking at very closely and saying, where is it? When is it going to happen? You think not, Leslie?
I 100% agree with you. Jobs would be the answer, in addition to teaching people more effective money management skills and financial wealth generation skills. But Mr. Lang,
mm-hmm.
I apply for the Prospect Ridge thing. What happened to me?
Well, I'm told. Well, we see that now. You'll find out soon. So the government will have to decide whether it's a program that it wants to continue with. And I can tell you. Now listen.
Minutes tell me.
Listen.
Apply. Qual gonna get something.
Listen. Elections have consequences, right? Here's what I mean. The government is gonna review that. We said. Stop, review, cancel. When the Ingram administration came in, they said that the FNM was engaged in a process of stop, review, cancel. Alfred says, by the way, a very astute texter reminded me that Fred Mitchell and Alfred says have prior cabinet experience, and that is true. So that makes a good chunk of that crew that have prior cabinet experience. Alfred says, the new Minister of Public Works has said that the rate reduction bond of BPL has to be taken back to cabinet to be what? Reviewed. Now, why would you review anything? This is a former administration started it. Why would you review anything unless the possibility exists that you could either stop it or cancel it if you don't continue it forward? Because that's the only reason why you review, or you may amend it or adjust it. So again, this is how this political rhetoric gets caught up with us, and we start talking about, you stop review. When you ask for change, you should get change. And the people should review the stuff. And if they don't think it's good, they should stop the stuff. And if they don't think it's good, they should cancel the stuff.
But that means I may not get my two-story house.
But what I wanted to tell you was this is what's going to happen. So they're going to review the program to see what the process was. And after satisfying themselves that this process was not one in which political considerations skewed it in favor of people that may have been more favorable to the FNM. They have to satisfy themselves with that. I don't know. They're going to satisfy themselves with that. And then they may make a determination, okay. We're satisfied that it was above board, maybe. And so, okay, maybe what we'll do is just add some more to it. Put some more in the chunk. Or just let it sit there for a long time and nothing happens. Elections have consequences. Administration to look at a program and assess it, review it, and if they feel it worthy and necessary, stop or cancel it. And I have no doubt that that will be taking place all around the place, as typically it does, no matter what anybody says. Otherwise, why hire a new group? If everything that happened continues as was before, why hire a new group? Does that change your direction? It does not. So I don't know, Leslie, what will happen to your particular situation. But again, you know, just wait and see. And, you know, your application was in, so you're a Bahamian. If the government wants to continue with the program, yeah, we'll you'll see.
Yeah.
So,
Mr. Lang, I have a question related to mortgages. I don't know if you can answer, but I always wanted to know. I heard that the foreclosed home prices are the prices of the value of the house and not the actual amount that just the person's owed. Because I thought you just need to pay the bank the amount that's owed on the mortgage to own the house. Well, you still have to pay for the whole value of the house.
Well, the reality is that when the bank is selling a house that's foreclosed, they are selling an asset that they have appraised for its market value. So the appraiser might say, so let's say your mortgage is $50,000 outstanding, but the home is $150,000 as appraised by the appraiser. Well, the bank will put that property there on the market for $150,000, generally speaking, at the value of the home, and see what takers they get. Now, some takers might say, no, I'm not buying that for $150,000. I'll give you a bid for $100,000. I'll give you a bid for $75,000. And the bank can go ahead. I am a little hazy, even though my logic and reasoning tells me. Where I'm a little hazy is when the bank gets an amount for the home above the outstanding balance on the loan, my understanding is that balance belongs to you. That's my understanding.
Really?
I could be wrong. So I'm gonna wait for some of my banker's friends.
Yeah, it's like the fact that we don't know.
Well, the only reason why I don't know is because I've heard different things.
Same here.
Yeah, I've heard different things, but the general proposition I've heard from attorneys is that the net difference of the sale is supposed to be to you. Now, I could see why some people might say that's not so, because let's say the bank is only able to fetch, say $40,000 for an outstanding $50,000 balance loan. Well, the expectation is that you still have to pay the $10,000. So if you have to still pay the $10,000 for the outstanding because the amount realized on the sale of the home was not sufficient, well, why don't you get the balance if the amount is more than sufficient? But again, I have many, many friends who are in the banking sector who listen, so maybe they will help. And one of them was text the show every day. So Citibank, who was in the mortgage business, maybe you could help us out and tell us what the answer is. This text says, congratulations on your son's graduation. My daughter graduated in January from St. Mary's University. Yes, that's where my son is, but didn't get to walk the stage due to the pandemic. Yes, lots of people had that issue. So we haven't enjoyed that feeling yet. Perhaps once she has her master's, all the best. Yes, that's true. We weren't around either, but he got the letter. And the letter said, yes, we are going to have a in-person graduation, but they're only inviting two people. This text says, great show as usual. You forgot to mention how PM Brave government deal with the mortgage relief. Yeah, I just finished talking with that. This text says, good afternoon and congrats to you and your son on his BA. So what do you think of the government being creative to combine NEMA, Ministry of Disaster Preparedness, and Bahamas Information Services? Whereas the public-private sectors can submit ideas for national improvement in all areas to this new ministry. If people love their country, they should give freely sensible, workable ideas as to help the government. Bless you. And I agree. People should help. And I think the combining of NEMA and the disaster ministry only makes sense because, quite frankly, they're doing basically the same. They're involved with the same effort. And so I think that only makes sense to have them work that way. But I thought NEMA was under the disaster preparedness ministry anyways. BI?
Yes.
And NEMA was a part of that ministry as I understood it.
Yeah, they were put under it.
Yeah, that's what I understood. So I don't think that there's anything new about that. Now, PIS was definitely not under it. And, you know, why that is a fit, if that is true, I couldn't say why that is a fit, because the BIS's responsibility is to broadly provide information about government doings and happenings and workings and so forth and so forth. And NEMA and disaster preparedness is only one aspect of that. Now, you could argue that being close to NEMA in times of disaster, maybe that ministry can be more instrumental and helpful. But again, if you want to make a minister responsible for disaster preparedness and the like, responsible for BIS, it doesn't matter. It doesn't matter because there's a separate group of people who do the NEMA, the BIS work, and you could direct and conduct and require them to do the things that are necessary across the government. So there's no real headache in doing it that way.
I mean, the larger question is, could they pull away the ministry? Like,
What do you mean, pull it?
Stop reviewing, cancel it?
Yes, because, you know, ministries aren't institutions in law, for instance. Like, so they're not body corporates. They are simply ways in which the government organizes itself around a particular set of government business. So you might have like the Ministry of Agriculture, I think is a body corporate. So you might have that. So there tends to be a Ministry of Agriculture, but you can make it the Ministry of Marine Agriculture, Marine Resources, and something else. Or you could change the name of it to the Ministry of Earthworks. You can do whatever you want. So these ministries can, and you can disband a ministry altogether. So the Bahamas has had ministries before that no longer exist. And then sometimes sports. Sometimes you have the Ministry of Youth, Sports, and Culture. Sometimes you have the Ministry of Education and Culture. And so these are all at the discretion of the Prime Minister.
Yeah, so we now have the Ministry of Health and Wellness.
Exactly.
The mental health aspect, which I thought was great.
Exactly. So and that's, again, at the discretion of the Prime Minister. But what people should know is, fundamentally, all that's happening is that parts of the business of the government that already exist is being concentrated or focused in an area called a ministry. And a ministry always has a permanent secretary as its chief administrative officer and as its chief financial officer. And then within that ministry may be departments. So there's a Ministry of Education. So when you look in the budget, you see the budget for the Ministry of Education, which might be $21 million. But the Department of Ministry of Education has a budget of $100+ million. Because all of the teachers, educators, the staff of the schools are part of the Department of Education, not the Ministry of Education. The Ministry of Education is the policy arm of the education enterprise. That's where the policies are made. That's where the directions are given. But the execution of policy and direction insofar as the educating of the school, the children of our schools, is done by the Department of Education. So it has the largest staff, the larger demands on resources and so forth. So it would have $100 million being led by, managed by a $20 million ministry.
I didn't know that. That's interesting.
Yeah, so, when you look at ministries and departments, that's what you'll see. So you see the Ministry of Works has a Department of Public Works. The Ministry of Agriculture has a Department of Agriculture. The Ministry of Finance has, would have charge of the Department of Treasury, the Customs Department, and so forth. Now, every area of the government isn't a department. A department is actually established by the public service. So you actually have to, because then you have to now actually create the post of director and deputy director, and you have to put them in the establishment and so forth. So it's a very formal process of creating departments as opposed to even ministries.
It's so departments may be more permanent or consistent across election periods than ministry?
Absolutely, absolutely. You will rarely see a change in the Department of Public Works, a change in the Department of Agriculture, a change in the Department, well, no longer the Department of Statistics, it's the Bahamas National Statistical Institute. So that's not no longer the case, but there is the consumer. So like you have a consumer affairs division, not a department, you see? So you won't have a director of consumer affairs, but you have a director of the Department of Social Services. And so those stay permanent because they are actually institutionalized entities within the government machinery. But a ministry, that's at the discretion of the prime minister. So he simply allocates parts of the government business to a ministry as a part of its portfolio.
So in your opinion, where do the greatest opportunities for increased efficiency can occur? At the ministry level or at the department level?
Well, most of the money is expended at the department level. So if you are going to have the level, but what is true is, it would be for the ministries to be more studious in evaluating expenditure against value received. So that the ministry says, because it's the ministry that ultimately goes to the Ministry of Finance for budget allocation and has to make the case along with the department. So the ministry has to evaluate the program and say, you know what? Honestly, we've been spending $1 million a year on this program for the last 10 years. And when it comes to what we said we should get out of it, we don't see that. And this is where it gets very difficult in trying to create efficiencies, because now what kind of politics is at work? It's not the politics of FNM PLP. It's the politics of when you take money from me, I feel lesser. And I don't want to be lesser. And so all kind of gymnastics gets played to justify why we should contest the government is the country's most important cultural expression, and we shouldn't be blah, 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 blah. And everybody sways in. And then when the politics comes to the minister, he say, you know what, I ain't fooling with that, because I don't want nobody in the newspaper cutting me up saying we cut the budget of Junkaloo. We cut the budget of sports. We cut the budget of regattas. We cut the budget of this thing in education and the next thing. You don't want that. So it becomes very robust once you start spending money in an area to not spend that much or spend it at all. Very difficult. That's why you notice your government budget expenditure don't go down. It goes up. It keeps going up, or it stays basically the same. Very difficult to reduce. And that's why it's very difficult for the government to reduce your taxes. Because they can't find the stomach to tell you, we're cutting that program out, we're cutting that program out, we're cutting this one out too.
it just sounds like a dismal situation.
not dismal, even though I would say challenging, yeah. But like, it's yeah.
I mean, it just sounds like an organism, like an organism. I mean, as you talking about it, I just see like, I don't know, this may not be the best description, but I feel like a slow, like a turtle, like just so many different components of the way the system works and it is intended to function as this body or as this organism, really, that's what it is. Then to appreciate, you know, I had someone from a different country have a conversation with me very recently, and her lamentation was that after, you know, 40 plus years, or even really, she was talking about the region, but the Bahamas, she used as an example that we should be a developed nation by now. We shouldn't have so many bottlenecks and inefficiencies, and things should be run much smoother. We should have this, that, and that. And and I don't know, it made me think, you know, and they use the comparison of other countries who may have been operating independently in different parts of the world for more or less the same period, or during, well, a longer period of time, but during their first 40 or 50 years of independence, they had managed to move from a state of dependency into a state of development. But we haven't been able to move as quickly. And it was almost like a cry, shame on us.
Well, I would challenge that enormously, only by first saying that person would have to give me their definition of development, because quite frankly, even in development economics, the definition isn't quite all that certain. It was said for a long time that the Bahamas was one of the few developing countries, third world countries, that reflected or demonstrated first world characteristics. How do I know? We have a substantially higher per capita income than China. We're not in the G7. We have a substantially higher per capita income than every country in the Americas, saving and except for the United States and Canada. So what is it that they're using as development? Our internet penetration rate, higher than many developing countries in the world. Our housing stock and middle class are more substantial and more wealthy than most developing countries in the world. So the question is one of what is it she or that person is looking at? Now, efficiencies in government, okay, who is out there measuring that in any country in the world exactly that much? Like, you know, so, and the point is not to suggest that the Bahamas shouldn't and couldn't have been further. I just question someone saying after 40 years, you should be here. Really? How old is India as a country? How old is China? I would look at that with some caution. And Archdeacon, late Archdeacon William Thompson, when I was having a similar lament, said to me, na Lang, and he said, just said this to me, no, be careful. You know, you can't be comparing us to places that have had like 300 and 1,000 and 3,000 years of history to get some things right and think that we should have by now. And this was like when we were just 30-something years old, be able to have our act together. Be careful, because, you know, every country, just like first people, have their own peculiarities, their own triumphs and challenges, and that the Bahamas is no different. But as to your point about the snail and what have you, I think that's actually a good analogy, because changing bureaucracies around the globe is very difficult. I would ask anyone to do an evaluation of the institutions in the United, how many new institutions have been created in that country over the last 100 years. And I think they will find that it has not been many. Like Homeland Security was one of them, one such, and came out of the September 11 disaster. But other than that, their departments have been essentially the same for decades. bureaucracies are very dangerous, difficult to change. And you know why? Because remember, the bureaucracy isn't just chairs and desks and buildings and tables and computers. It's people. People have invested their energies, their lives, their careers in those places. And change for that institution means change for me. And I'm going to fight for the things I believe in, even if you don't think it is generating the value you think it should generate. So politicians get put up against people who are, you are an officer, but this is where I earn my money. This is where I get my pay. This is how I feed my family. And you want to get rid of us? That don't happen easily in a small country in particular, where the politics is very sensitive and very tight.
Less food for thought.
It's generally one of the things that we must always try to remember when we talk about change. Our world is run by organizations created by people, operated by people to serve people. And any effort to do anything to the organization is an effort to do something to the people. And people have views about what you do to them. We have a couple of texts here. This text says, good afternoon, Mr. Lang. I'm so sorry. Knowing the PLP, it might not happen. If I was all those who applied, I would protest. You have the right to not be afraid. It is your risk. Please read, Mr. Lang. Okay. So this administration, I hope, does not go on a spiteful vendetta. Well, Mr. Davis said he's not that kind of person and he's not minded to do them kinds of things. And so, you'll see. His text says, a God bless morning and may God of all, say, good evening, sir. If a foreclosure home balance is $50,000 and the bank sells for $40,000, that would indicate that they made the decision to accept the loss, $10,000, I'm assuming. Yes, that's true. Because they didn't have to sell below the owed balance. That's true. But they may also have weighed the cost of waiting on a particular asset and it deteriorating further, and they're taking even additional losses. So that could happen as well. Says, good afternoon, Lang, and congratulations on your son, as well as both you and your wife for standing behind. I know how you both should feel as parents, and I know the feeling. However, my daughter graduated with a double bachelor's degree in environmental studies and was unable to get a job in the Bahamas. Due to that, she's now working in the U.S. for 2 months and doing well, and has encouraged our next daughter to do the same. The Bahamas government needs to take a long look at not opening jobs for students they send over to study abroad and only find out no job is available. That's a real issue. That's a real challenge for sure. But, you know, I tell young people that, you know, if where you are doesn't nurture your hopes and dreams, there's nothing wrong with going where you can get your dreams nurtured. And then later on, if the opportunity permits, you can always come again and do what you could do where you would have liked to be. So sometimes the country just ain't got it for you. And if you have an opportunity, you have to take it where you could take it. Am I lying, Leslie?
I agree with you, but I think there's a lie that no one ever told me that I believed. And it was that when I got the government loan, that I really thought that it meant that once I graduated school, I would come back, the government would have a job for me so that I could pay them back the money
you believe that lie? Who told you that? But who told you that?
I thought that made sense. I just thought it was logical. I'm like, they're not going to give me this money unless they are going to assure themselves.
No.
I came home and I felt the greatest shock that I could not find work.
Read the fine print. You did not read the fine print.
I was writing on my letters, I have the government loan and I need to pay it back. So I'm looking forward on my cover letter.
you wanted the government to have the program. It used to have, you know, that the government used to have a bond program. And so
yeah, that's what I was on. You were on a bonded scholarship. I was on the
not the loan guarantee. That's different.
I don't know. I know that I got something. I was awarded something.
How recent was it? How recent was it when you got?
So this was in 2000.
Oh yeah. You were on the loan guarantee program.
And I was told that I had to come back for the years that I got the scholarship, that I got the funds, how many years it was that I needed to come back to work that same amount of years. So I just assumed that they would have given me a job to work back.
Yeah, no. They didn't have that. The bonded, under the government bonded scholarship, when you got the scholarship and you came back, they gave you a job under that program. But the government stopped that. And under the loan guarantee, remember the government sent off 2,000 people. It wasn't going to guarantee 2,000 people in 1 year and then hundreds of others in the year after. The government could not possibly guarantee all those people a job. That would have been entirely insane and impossible. Impossible.
That's just what my 23-year-old mind told me.
Understood. And we are going to take our final break. You're listening to Z Live. I'm Shivago Lang, your host here with Mrs. Leslie Archer. And we'll be back after this break.
Take a stand, take a stand. Everybody, everybody, come take my hand, come take my hand. We'll walk this road together through the storm, whatever weather, cold or warm. Send you know that you're not alone. Holler if you feel like you make it down the same road.
Summer is heating up, and Burger King Nassau is bringing the flavor. Introducing our all-new take on a classic chicken sandwich, the Barbecue Swiss Crispy King. Our new sandwich is full of smoky and tangy flavor and features our crispy chicken patty with tangy chipotle sauce, onion rings, bacon, Swiss cheese, lettuce, and tomato, plus a smoky barbecue sauce on a soft potato bun. The new Barbecue Swiss Crispy King chicken sandwich with fries and a Pepsi is a summer treat you will love to eat, but only available for a limited time, and only at Burger King Nassau, where taste is king.
Sheila, you okay? I see smoke coming from your window.
Jen
is a mess. You have insurance?
If I have insurance, I pulled my phone out, pulled up the Royal Star Assurance app, and in no time, I was on live chat with RSA rep, sent pics of the damage, filed my claim on the spot.
Wow, I don't think my insurance got that kind of app.
You got to go to RSA for that.
Download the RSA app today. Live chat available weekdays 9 to 5.
Have you taken a look at those investment options yet?
Too busy. Look at today. Workout, breakfast, drop kids at school, back-to-back meetings, dog from the groomer, nails, and that's all before 12. How come you're so chill?
That's because my money is as busy as you.
At RF, we find the best Bahamian and international investments to keep your money busy so you can spend more time focusing on you. Contact us at rfgroup.com to find out more. RF, money at work.
This is Guardian Radio, 96.9 FM. Fresh news, smart talk, all day.
I'm not afraid to take a stand, take a stand. Everybody, everybody, come together through the storm, whatever weather, cold or warm. Send you know that you're not alone. Holler if you feel like you make it down the same road.
Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen, to these remaining moments of the show. You're listening to Z Live. I'm Shivago Lang, your host. So glad you could join us here today. I'm here with Mrs. Leslie Archer from the Government and Public Policy Institute. There's a number of young people also in the Davis cabinet, younger people, I should say, they will therefore be able to set their mark. I have to say that there are a number of those appointments. I have no complaints about any of the appointments per se. I do have some eyebrow raising about one or two of that. Sooner rather than later, we may begin to hear things that we go, oh my God, no, truly, what, really, really, that what you really said that, really? But I did see some appointments by some individuals that I thought represented some good personalities to have in place and what have you. So, you know, we'll have to see how that works. And I know that I believe that there are people in perhaps the financial services community who might find comfort in Ryan Pinder's appointment as Attorney General, because given the delicateness of dealing with the international regulatory bodies and our country over the financial reporting matters, that perhaps his familiarity with the financial services sector, having worked in the industry and having served as Minister of Financial Services, that he will be able to nuance legislation more delicately to that sector and what might be required to fulfill the obligations under those international regulatory bodies. So there are those who may feel that that's a good fit there. Miles LaRoda, I think, will be a capable soul. He was for a long time chairman of the Public Service Commission, having served under an FNM and PLP administration, I might add. Why? Because he is a really balanced, thoughtful fellow, very sensible fellow. And while I might disclose that he is a relative of my wife, that has nothing to do with my experience with him and interacting with him as a professional. So I think there's something to be said there. I know that some people raised their eyebrow when Glenys Mahana-Martin became Minister of Education, because I guess in their many's eyes, that's not something they would have thought would happen. But the truth is that Glenys Mahana-Martin, energy to any space she's operating, and that kind of energy in education and that kind of passion and dedication actually may work to the benefit of many. You know, the only one thing I'd say, I look forward to seeing the the rapport between the Ministry of Education and the Teachers Union now. President Linda Wilson, because you have these two ladies at the helm. Maybe that produces a different dynamic, you know, and right. two very passionate ladies, I might add, two very energetic ladies.
I think it would be good. I think it would be good.
I'm a curious onlooker. I'm a curious onlooker. Now, yesterday I talked about no Minister of Finance being named. I'm told that Mr. Davis was sworn in as Minister of Finance. I'm told that. I have not seen that in the press. I must have missed that. Are listening and can confirm that. Please confirm that for me. Because I would have thought that if that happened, in fact, it would have been like kind of news. But I may have missed it. And I confess, I may just have missed it. Okay? So I don't know. But I'm looking forward to see. So I saw some Wayne Monroe at National Security. I have to confess, it's a curiosity for me. It is a curiosity. I am really looking to see how that works out. Alfred Sayers, of course, is a thoughtful person with a kind of very balanced, even keel temperament. So him in public works, I think may in fact work. Okay, so I someone is telling me Davis is Minister of Finance. Said read same in press. Okay, great. I believe you. I believe you. So now we have a Minister of Finance, a Minister of State in that ministry. So, and that's not a bad idea in a crisis, to have finance in the hands of the prime minister so that, you know, those big and heavy, difficult decisions can be made there. He can always get guidance and advice broadly and widely from wherever he needs it. He would not be the first lawyer to be Minister of Finance. Hubert Alexander Ingram was Minister of Finance. Dr. Minnis was the doctor, kept Ministry of Finance, even though he had a Minister of State. So Ferry Christie was Minister of Finance and Michael Alkides was the Minister of State, you know. So you, Paul Adley was a lawyer and Minister of Finance. Eddie Hanna was, for time, Minister of Finance, and he was a lawyer, though he had to train in economics, I believe. And Sir Lyndon held the post for a time, and he was a lawyer. So lawyers have been Minister of Finance in the Commonwealth of the Bahamas many times. In fact, the breakage in that was really Sir William Allen. Sir William Allen was the last time Minister of Finance who was a finance person and who wasn't a lawyer and wasn't a Minister of State. He was a Minister of State in his first 2 years, but then after that, he was Minister of Finance for about seven, eight years in the country.
What about Turnquest?
Yeah, forgive me. Yes, Peter Turnquest, an accountant. That's right, was the last person. Thank you for reminding me. Yes. But so Peter Turnquest and Sir William, in the whole line of Ministers of Finance in the country, would have been the only, and I'm talking about those who occupied the portfolio fully. So while I was there, I was Minister of State. I didn't occupy the portfolios. Mr. Ingram did. But Peter, yes, Peter Turnquest and Sir William were the only, I would say, in the last 30 plus years of persons who held that post and were not lawyers. So the full cabinet listing now is Mr. Brave Davis, the Honorable Deputy Prime Minister, Chester Kupu is also Minister of Tourism, Aviation and Investments. Senator Ryan Pinder is Attorney General and Minister of Legal Affairs. Fred Mitchell, Minister of Foreign Affairs and Public Service. Glenys Hannah-Martin, Minister of Education, Technical and Vocational Training. Alfred Sayers, Minister of Works and Utilities. Dr. Michael Darvill, Minister of Health and Wellness. Dr. Darvill was in the Parliament, in the Cabinet before. Okay. Senator Michael Alkides, Minister of Economic Affairs and Senate Leader of the Government Business. Clay Sweeting, he's the Minister of Agriculture and Marine Resources and Family Island Affairs. Wayne Monroe, Minister of National Security. Jomo Campbell is Minister of State for Legal Affairs. Obi Wilstrom is Minister of Social Services and Urban Development and Leader of the Government Business in the House of Assembly. Okay, that's a good compromise for him. Keith Bell, Minister of Labor and Natural Resources. Well, there you go, Brother Miller. You are able now to come full luck in charge of that area where the belief is by you and others that there are billions to be had by the Bahamian public. Well, you now have a chance, full chance at it. Joe Beth Colby Davis, Minister of Transport and Housing. Ginger Moxie, Minister of Grand Bahama. And I don't know if she's been, she's even not even Minister of State. She is full portfolio Minister for Grand Bahama. Oh, yeah. Mr. Darvill was Minister for Grand Bahama, so he was also in the cabinet before. Mario Boleg, Minister of Youth, Sports and Culture. Basil McIntosh, the Minister of State for the Environment. Miles LaRota, Minister of State in the Office of the Prime Minister. Pia Glover Roll, Minister of State for the Public Service. Lisa Raming, Minister of State for Social Services and Urban Development. Zane Lightbourne, Minister of State for Education, Technical and Vocational Institutes. So let me count that number now. 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, 13, 14, 15, 16, 17, 18, 19, 20. 21, 22 cabinet ministers. 22. Okay, so 22. How many of those are members of parliament? Plenty. least 19. There you go. Any final words, Leslie? We got 2 minutes.
No, I'm learning a lot. I'm excited about what it is to come, and I like how you works and how the changes are taking place, you know, and what we can look forward to or cross our fingers, really, as we look forward to it.
Well, we'll all be watching for sure, observing, commenting, and I wish the government well.
Sorry, how come housing and transportation together?
Housing and transportation, is it together?
Yeah, I think you said.
It doesn't matter. You know, it's sometimes you try to get congruency between things, but it doesn't matter. Sometimes the prime minister just decides to put something in a portfolio. So it you know, there's not always necessarily congruence between things.
Well, I wish them all the best. You know, there is some hope in the air, or there is at least some anticipation in the air, and I hope they seize it and stretch it to help us get through this period.
Somebody is saying to me that there is no minister response. Government business is not put in a portfolio. It is under the charge of the prime minister, period, by default. So he don't have to say nothing. If it ain't and nobody else, he's responsible for it. You've been listening to Z Live. I'm Shabago Lang, your host. I've been here with Mrs. Leslie Archer. Listen, have a great evening. God bless. And we'll talk to you again tomorrow. Naja Black is up next.
Take a stand, everybody.